This is Should We Just Watch It Real Quick, the only podcast hosted by two married people who get up way too early to record a podcast. I am one of your hosts, Dr. Damien Gibson. You can go to 112 years of circadian rhythm school to be called Mr. Thank you very much. And in the blue corner, it's the Raging Cajun, it's the Italian Gelatin, it's Kelly, Big Whoop, Wanna Fight About It for Stuka. Here she is.
I'm Italian. Can't stop yawning, I'm tired.
Coming straight out the gate with that high energy that we all love so much.
I'm so tired. I had a coffee already though.
I had a coffee the other day.
Ugh, far out.
Oh my god.
Well, we finished watching Friends finally.
Yeah, well, what else? Hang on, what else is going on?
We both had our jobs.
Yeah. Do we want to talk about that or we will spiral?
Spiral.
But a good thing happened. Or do we want to talk about IPEP? IPEP?
Yeah, but then we have to tell people if it doesn't work.
Yeah, so sorry. I probably shouldn't have brought it up. Anyway, well, IVF stuff's been happening in the background. We haven't been around for the last couple of weeks.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's a good excuse why things haven't been happening. Yeah. Maybe why I'm tired and stuff.
If an episode doesn't come out during a week, you can just rest assured that it's probably because of one of our mental health statuses, if not both.
Yeah.
Usually the only time that we can both record, because I work most Saturdays now, is a Sunday. And there are times where we just get up and we physically can't.
Yeah.
We just can't do it. And it's not anything about you guys or whether we want to do the podcast or not. But listen, the great thing about podcasts is that you can hit subscribe, and when the episodes drop, they're there, you know?
Yeah.
Shout out to CPAC, Celia, who we saw during the week, and she was telling us that she was catching up on episodes.
Aww.
So if Seals can do it, so can you.
Yeah.
Just bank the episodes and then listen.
She's
to
very
like
supportive,
four.
Mate.
She is very supportive. Thank you, Celia.
Yeah.
Bank the episodes, listen to 3, 4, 5 in a row, and it's like hanging out with us for an afternoon. And then you don't have to deal with us never leaving your house because we talk too much. What else has been going on?
I have been watching a bit of TV now. So I started a few new shows.
Mm-hmm. I also tried to start a new show so we can.
What was that?
The Man on the Inside. The new show from Mike Schur, who made The Good Place, was a co-creator on Parks and Recs. I'm a big fan of his, especially after The Good Place. I've never been more sort of sucker punched by a TV show than The Good Place. If you guys don't know, for the vast majority of my working career, I've worked in call centers, which means you work with a very disparate group of people. But for the most part, you work with sort of very... I don't know how to say this without sounding awful. Just like, everyday people. Like, just that they've got basic tastes and stuff. And there were these two girls I worked with, and I liked them a lot. But they were kind of just, you know, mums. And they both kept, like, harassing me to watch The Good Place. And I, me being, like, the stuck-up person that I am, I was like, I'm not watching that shit. And then eventually, I think it was during the pandemic, maybe... I watched a couple of episodes and I was like, yeah, this is fine. And then by episode 5, I just found myself like enthralled. And I thought the writing on The Good Place was some of the most inventive TV writing I've ever seen. Almost like a writer daring himself to fail. He kept writing himself into corners and then writing himself back out again. And that cast is fantastic. Never had a high opinion of, is it Kristen Bell?
Mm-hmm.
Until the show, and then I was like, oh, I get why everybody loves her. She's like super personable.
What the fork?
Yeah. So this, The Man on the Inside is Mike Schur and Ted Danson, who, I mean, fuck.
He's so good.
Ted Danson is...
He's so
good. It's truly remarkable the career the guy has had, you know? Like, Cheers is... At university, I was maybe the second or third class I was in. It was a TV writing class. I was told to watch the pilot of Cheers. Basically, as like a perfect example of how to write a pilot. And then I ended up watching every episode of that show because I'd never really watched it because it always felt like a mum and dad show when I was growing up, even though I'd watch Frasier. Anyway, and then remember Becca came out and there was sort of this like punchline of like, Ted Danson's career's gone down the toilet, he's doing this show, blah, blah.
Becca wasn't terrible though.
No, not terrible.
It was House before House.
Yeah, essentially, but a sitcom version of it. And then he's on Curb, then he's on The Good Place, and now he's doing this Man on the Inside. I don't think Ted Danson doesn't do – I only watched the pilot of The Man on the Inside. Ted Danson doesn't do anything wrong. He's acting his part really well. My problem with this show – and I wasn't a fan of it, by the way. I'm going to give it one grump right off the top. I thought the writing was lazy. There's
Michael Schur did write the episode though, so that's weird.
Didn't
he? Did he wrote that particular episode?
Yeah. Well, that's what's so disappointing about it is that someone who you're comparing an artist to work that they've done previously, and he said it to me. He set a very high benchmark with Parks and Rec and The Good Place. The things I didn't like about this show, it's got the streamer lighting problem where everything is super bright. It looks like a Hallmark movie. The people who create these shows are just completely out of touch. I mean, this show is meant to be about a family dealing with the wake of the matriarch of their family sort of passing away. The daughter lives in a fucking 7-story McMansion. Ted Danson lives in this uber cool, like everybody, like for people to live in the houses that they're living in this show, they'd have to be earning $350,000 US a year. It just immediately took me out of it of like, well, hang on a sec. This guy was a university lecturer. He wasn't a fucking Wall Street banker. Like, why does he have so much money? And then my main drag with this show, and I know that the premise of the show is an older gentleman works with a private investigator to uncover crimes that are happening in a upmarket nursing home. Not a bad premise for a comedy show, but the way that they get him there is his daughter sort of haranguing him for not being over his mum quick enough, her mum, his wife, and that the only way that he could get over that is to go back to work. Quote, you need to get back to work, even though it's stated in the show that he's 75 years old. So he's 10 years past retirement age, but there's this capitalistic nonsense being shoved down your throat of like, well, the only way that you could be a productive man, person of society and to get over being sad and lonely because your life partner has fucking passed away of dementia, which also would have been a hugely traumatic thing for him, is that he needs to fucking it's such bullshit. He needs to get back to work and he needs to go and work in a nursing home where there's lots of people who have dementia so he can face his fears.
Oh boy.
Like, just bullshit. Just utter bullshit. And the moment that the biggest crime the show commits, it's not funny. It's a comedy and there's no, it's not even like Good Place or Friends light comedy where you get a couple of chuckles an episode. I sat there stony face for 35 minutes.
You don't think it's a victim of pilot syndrome?
No, because the pilot is usually, well, I was going to say usually the best episode.
No, that's a thing.
Well, Breaking Bad, it was.
You've got to give something 3 or 4 episodes.
Nah, I'm not doing that. Sorry. If you don't get me by the end of the first page, I'm not reading your book. If you don't get me by the end of the first episode, you've got to give me something to keep going with, right? Like, Barry is a show that I've been watching recently. I got to the end of season 2 and I was like, you know what? That's probably enough for me. But there was enough. Bill Hader and the creative team there had done enough by the end of episode 1 for me to keep going. You know? The Boys the same. This show had no redeemable features at all. And yeah, maybe it will be a show that in 2 years' time people will be like, you know what I'm watching that's great? The Man on the Inside. But I don't think so. And I've been watching a lot of YouTube and TikTok videos of like, you know, filmmakers sort of pointing out all the grossness of streamers as far as lighting and how photography is directed and stuff, and now I can't unsee it. Mm. And this this show was all of those things. You know, the only thing it didn't have was like an AI like cartoon monster walking through the fucking show that would have made it even worse. Mm. I would not recommend it. Don't even bother. One grump.
Oh, what a shame.
Yeah, I was disappointed because I was excited. Like I said to you, like, oh, Mike Schur's got a new show. I want to check it out.
Mm.
So I'm not always Captain Negative. I just want to put that. There are things that I get excited about and things that I'm like, oh, cool. And then, yeah, I felt like I was let down.
Hmm. What a shame. Oh. Because we love Ted Danson. He's so good in Curb.
Yeah, he's great.
He really hams up this, like, idea that Ted Danson's a great guy and, like, I don't know, it's just always really
fun. But the thing that Larry David does that's always so, like, cutting is that Larry is right about Ted. Like, at first you meet Ted Danson, he does come across as a super nice guy, and Larry's like, oh, he just does it for the publicity. And then it turns out eventually that he does just do it for the publicity.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, in the last season when Larry gets arrested for standing up for a black woman in the Georgian election for drinking a bottle of water, and then Ted flies to the other side of the country to lead protests on behalf of Larry, you know?
It's good. It's good. Yeah, that's great. I love that.
Yeah, this is really good. No fault of Ted Danson's. Every scene he's in, he's holding up the show. It's the only thing that keeps your interest.
Mm.
But there's so much of that sort of like, she's behind me, isn't she? Ugh. Sort of humor, you know what I mean?
I hate that pantomime.
Well, that just happened, like that kind of shit writing, you know? They're just like,
what a shame.
Yeah, and like the chick from Brooklyn Nine-Nine, the hardcore chick, Diaz.
Yeah.
She's in it playing a completely different character. Mm. She's like the head nurse at this nursing home.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, Diaz from Brooklyn Nine-Nine, she's great. So I was excited to see certain people in the show, but there was just so much of like, did he just say that kind of stuff? Where I'm like,
old people are weird. They don't understand pronouns.
Yeah. And like Jackie Weaver shows up and she's like hitting on Ted Danson, and like everybody reacts to two people in their 70s flirting like it's the fucking weirdest thing. You know what I mean?
Jackie Weaver, the original Sherry from Cozy Fan Tutte, the play Cozy, which then became the movie Cozy. But she was the original Sherry. Kiss him again and I'll break your fucking arm. That's where that line's from.
That's a really, really good impersonation, bub.
But that's because she's, it's just so like, but just the way it's a real ochre
Aussie accent. You genuinely sound
kiss
like
him again and I'll break your fucking arm.
You sound like Jackie Weaver. That's crazy. Yeah.
I am a parish.
Do we want to save the end of Friends for the end of the episode?
I don't mind.
What else have you been watching?
I watched a show on Binge called All Her Fault with Sarah Snook.
Oh, yeah. I tucked in and out of this.
Yeah. I very much think you should watch it because I feel like the writing is excellent. It's very, very – it's not one of those shows where people are talking and it's like fast dialogue. It feels very, very like, oh, this is a real, like they will embrace a silence and like embrace a, hang on, what?
Mm.
Like, you know, so I think you should watch it. But and some good twists, like, and they jump straight in, like no bullshit. The opening scene is Sarah Snook knocking on a door of her son's at a play date. She knocks on the door and an older lady answers and she's like, oh, hey, you must be the nanny. I'm here to pick up my son. She's like, sorry, there's no kids here. And then it starts. So basically, yeah, she was her kid gets picked up after school by a nanny because the mum goes, hey, should we have a play date with my kid and your kid on Monday? And she goes, oh, great. And she's like, great, here's my dress. And they've met before, you know, and this is all over text message. And she goes, here's my dress. The nanny will be at the door. But, you know, just to say who you are, it'll be fine. So, yep, no problem. And then, this chick is like, I don't know what you're talking about. And it's really – and it even felt realistic, like the way when she was trying to figure out what was going on. Like even the interaction with this lady where she was like, come in. just like wasn't like, I'm sorry, I can't help, like an American movie.
Yeah.
And this is the thing, because it actually was filmed in Australia. It was filmed in Melbourne. So you see all like Melbourne skyline. It's supposed to be Chicago. And like the convention center and all this fun stuff. And there's people that I recognize, I know through comedy or whatever, like in little bit parts.
Yeah.
And it's some of the people, like there's like someone's husband in it. He's an Australian actor. And I was like, good accent. Couldn't tell. But some people, it's just that little twang where they're like, you know, we've just got to get from A to B. And it's that little, you know, where I'm like, like the chick that plays the older woman who answers the door.
Hmm.
When I looked up the IMDb and stuff, she is Australian.
Yeah.
And I was like, she's done a fucking amazing job.
Hmm.
Like she really was like, but also, yeah, it was just so humanized the way she was like, you know what? Come inside, love. Let's get to the bottom of this.
Yeah.
Like it was like, that's what would happen.
Yeah.
And then spoiler, spoiler, spoiler. Oh man, there were so many moments in this show. It's like eight episodes maybe. And I binged it in 2 days. It's on Binge.
Right.
And I've messaged all of my mates going, can we fucking people watch this, please? I need to discuss, because there was a lot of elements of like family life and mental load, like some people doing more than others, some people doing too much, you know, like the head kind of father in it, he does too much, you know, like he thinks he's helping and he's like running the house, but he is hurting everyone with his too much, you know, like I am the one who takes care of everyone. I am the mental load. And it's like when it's done too much. But then there's this brilliant fucking scene with the mother of the original. So the original kid play date, that mother is obviously like racked with guilt, because it was her nanny that has been with her family for like the last 8 months or something, that came with references. She's the one who took the kid. And then we find out why later on, right? And she's racked with guilt. So she's like reaching out and hanging out and blah, blah, blah. But what kind of comes out, what kind of gets revealed about her is that she has a massive like publishing company, and she's like a real like, you know, girl boss. But like she's really sweet. Dakota Fanning, man, she's fucking – I find it so easy to watch her. She's a fucking so great.
Mm-hmm.
Like on – paper. I don't know how this character was on paper, but it seemed very waspy and mousy and very quiet. And you know, but she made this character so fucking interesting and direct. And you know what I mean? There's just something about when, like, yes, there's characters that are written well, but there's also the actor bringing something to it where you go, oh, this is so good.
Mm.
They've made it real meaty. And that's her. Like, and then just like it's just like these interactions that she has with her husband, where he's like a high school teacher, and he set a precedent in the house where he's like, "I'm so busy at my job that I can't possibly do these extra things."
Yeah,
and she's like a massive boss of a $1 million company, and he's a high school teacher. Now we don't want to say who's, you know, it should be equal, but he has. And when she kind of leans on him going, you know, we don't have a nanny now, I need you to help out. He was like, hey, I didn't sign up for this shit, all right? I've got a job to do. And she's like, you know, you can see her mind going, I have a job to do too. Why do you get 100% like not responsible when I, you know what I mean? Like we have to work as a team. But he just really put his foot down and was like, I didn't sign up for this, right? You want to have a kid? You have a kid. I need my alone time. Like that was his thing where, which is like fine and stuff, but it's just something about it where, I don't know, you know what I mean? Like, because they show both spectrums. They show the dad who's useless, but then they show the dad who is so hands-on that he's like hurting people, you know? But also the title of the thing is called All Her Fault, because there's all these little bits and pieces of women being blamed for other, whether it's a, you know, a kid, another woman or another man doing something wrong, where it's always the mum's, like, just, you know, the fact that the nanny stole this child. And when the police were interviewing him, they were like, you know, so where did you find her? And she's like, I found her through an agency. She had three references, you know, and I spoke to all of them. They were very highly regarded. You know, she had a police check, like all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And then the cop said to the dad, you know, what did you think of the references? And he's like, I don't get involved with that stuff. That's all her. And just the blame, like he had zero accountability.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, and it was such a small moment. And he didn't come across as an asshole. He wasn't like, blame her. He was just like, oh, weaponized incompetence. It was like that. Anyway, but the fucking twists and turns of this story. Am I giving spoilers?
Yeah, we always give spoilers.
Oh, all right.
All spoilers, no facts.
No facts. So basically, and this is like over the course, like basically this kid's missing. You know, there's no ransom. It's 3 days, 4 days, blah, blah. And then finally around about the fourth, fifth episode, they were able to identify the person who took the kid was the nanny. Why the nanny, blah, blah, blah. And then through like, you know, investigations, blah, 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 they found the nanny was talking to this guy on the street with the kid.
Mm.
So they plastered that guy's face everywhere. And the woman from the first episode comes into the police station. She goes, I know that person. He used to be a foster kid of mine. You're like, what the fuck? So she's like, and she's like doing the right thing. She's like, I don't know. Like he used to be foster, like, and they're like, you know, was he a bad kid? She's like, he wasn't a bad kid, but he did like kind of get into oxys. And last I heard he did, I think he went to jail for holding. So they investigate that. Yeah, he was in jail for 5 years for possession of oxys, you know, but he wasn't a violent person and he wasn't a bad person. And, you know, she was like, he wasn't, you know, it's pretty fucked up when he came to me, but he was with me for like 2 years until he turned 18. And I said, my door is always open for you. So it was like that. And then, and this is important because the cop who does all the investigating, who also has an autistic son, very like nonverbal autistic son. So you see his journey where he's like trying to get him into a good school and all this stuff. It's heartbreaking. Mm. But through the investigation of this woman, I just thought this was such a good thing to do. He came back to, you know, Sarah Snook, the mum, and was like, you know, told her what had happened. And she's like, why? I don't understand. I don't know this woman. Why in the text message where it said, here's my address, why did he send me to that woman?
Hmm.
Like, why did they use her address? Because he would have known that that would have been somehow that would have been like gone back to him. They would have traced it, you know?
Yeah.
So why did he do that? And the cop goes, I think he did it because he knew that you were about to have a really bad day and he just wanted to make sure that you were in the best hands possible. So what a fucking character development. So we know that this kid is a good person and he doesn't want to do it.
Yeah.
So it's the woman. Why is the woman taking the kid? I don't know. I feel like I almost don't want to give spoilers away because the jump cut is so big. Oh, I'll just tell you. Anyway. So we find out that 5 years earlier, Sarah Snook and her husband, on their way home from the hospital with their newborn baby, they're in a car accident. And in the other car is that girl and her newborn baby.
Right.
And the Peter, the dad, he's the only one conscious after the car accident. It's like bang, bang, bang. And he gets out of the car and Sarah Snook looks like she's dead in the car. And you don't see the baby, but you see him see the baby and their baby is definitely dead. And he gets out of the car and he can hear a baby crying from the other car. And then when he goes to the other car, the mum in the seat, who ends up being this nanny years later, she looks dead. And he calls the police, you know, blah, blah, blah. He's like, and they're on their way. And then he picks up the baby's crying in the back seat, her baby. He picks up the little boy. It's a little boy as well. And that baby's crying, but it's not hurt. And he swaps the babies over.
Hmm.
He puts the dead baby in her car.
Right.
So they've been bringing up this other child. But he didn't tell anyone. No one else knew.
Does he get caught?
Well, this is the thing. So she was adamant. And because she was like, she was only young. She was like 17.
Yeah.
And she, in hospital, they were like, your baby died when she came to out of her coma. She was in coma for a few weeks. She was like, he's not dead. He was crying. Like, she's adamant. She went crazy with it because she's like, I am adamant that my baby didn't die. So she does her research and finds out. And then she's able to find the kid and get him alone. And you see it. And from their interaction, she's like, it's my kid.
Why don't they do a DNA test?
Because she's like this 17-year-old kid. Like, and she's like, you know, the father of the baby is that foster kid and he's in jail. Like, no one believed her. She's like from a poor family, wrong side of the tracks. She kept on saying it and no one believed her, right? So when she met the kid, she knew. And the kid, so the kid's got this, they talk about in the show, the kid's got this, like, I don't think it's a disease. I think it's like a neuro kind of thing, a brain thing where he sees certain words he identifies them as colors. So he's like, Monday is orange, Tuesday is blue.
Mm.
And when they first meet, she says, I'm the same way. And they talk about, you know, like, when I see this color, blah, blah. Anyway, this is a very specific neurodivergent thing in your brain and it's hereditary.
Mm.
And the cop actually picks it up because he sees the kid's drawings and sees that he's drawing things with a color, like a – anyway, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then he also knows that the nanny that they're trying to find has got that thing as well. So the cop had already picked something was going on where he was like, so basically she finds out and that's why she takes the kid because she's like, he's my kid in the first place. But Sarah Snook has no idea. Cut two, she sees the family. So basically the dad is trying to do the right thing but he's just controlling everything. You know what I mean? Like he shouldn't, you know, he was like, I thought, and when it but comes
out.
But
do they all find out in the end that?
Only Sarah Snook knows because the nanny goes to see her and tells her everything and then the husband shoots her and kills her, kills the nanny. And she's like, why did you do that? And he goes, don't you understand? If people knew what was happening, they'll take our son away. She has to die for us to keep our son. And it's like, oh, fuck. You know what I mean? It's fucking. So now it's about her going, he's not a safe person. And before she dies, she's like, just promise me. She's like, I'm not going to take him back because he's, all he knows is you guys. She's like, I'm not taking him back. I've resigned to it. I just want you to know what he did and I want you to protect our son from him. And then he shoots her. So now she's like, fuck, I got it. So now it's she has to get rid of the husband without him, you know what I mean? And then it sort of turns out that he has throughout the whole season, he's got a really bad soy allergy and she plants soy. And then it's all like, she's calculated. She had to be really calculated. She got rid of him. It's so good. It's so good. Dude, I can see. You're like enthralled. You should have watched it.
No.
It's so good. Sounds
like everyone's awful.
Well, this show. One of the tagline for the show is one of the cops at the beginning goes, look at all these nice people. Are they going to end up killing each other? You know what I mean? But it's like there's so much more to it. But I was like the twists and turns, man. I was like the baby thing I did not see coming.
Yeah, that sounds pretty entertaining.
And it didn't come out of nowhere either.
I watched bits and pieces of it. I just didn't see the end. So I kind of knew most of that story. I just didn't know the kids had been swapped over. Didn't know the dad had killed the original mum. And I didn't realize Sarah Snook killed her husband, which is the same
but
guy.
Like, but anyway. She had soy and then she kissed him. And then he's like, oh, no. And she's like, oh, no. She's like, oh, did I? And then so they go to the car to get his EpiPen and he does it and it doesn't work. And he looked at the date and he's like, this is how to date. What's this doing in there? And she's like, oh, no, I always take out, you know, make sure the old, because after a year they expire. And he goes, she goes, I don't know where that came from. I always manage your allergies, don't I? Don't I manage your allergies? And he's looking at her and he can see, he knows. He's like, fuck, she's done this on purpose. And then the cop kind of cottoned on to what she had done. And they're interviewing all the family. And because of family, he had done something bad to everyone in the family as a way of trying to keep the family together and destroying, you know. And then through all everyone's interviews, they're like, she, you know, they all defended her. And then at the end, the cop's like, I know what you did. I 100% know what you did. And I know this and I know that. But I also know about the baby. He's like, I know. He's like, even though the report came in that it was self-defense gunshot wound, he goes, I know that he killed her to keep her quiet and that the best place for that little boy to be is with you and not with him. So he's like, so I'm not doing anything and I wish you a good life. Oh, so fucking good. I was in, man. I feel like I've just talked for ages. But
how many grumps?
I'll give it fucking, you know what? I'm going to give it 4¾.
Yeah.
And that. The last quarter is because the main chick's name is Marissa. No one in real life is called Marissa. Everyone loves putting the name Marissa as a person's character name in every fucking show. And in real life, no one is called that. Do you know any Marissas? No. It's not a name. It's stupid. Marissa. Hey, Marissa. It's such a... ugh. And also, if someone was called Marissa, we wouldn't be using the three syllables all the time. We would be called... hey, Riz, you'd be called something, you know, like a nickname.
Hmm.
That's the one thing that is not true. Stop calling people Marissa in scripts. Use normal words like Jen. You know, Jen, Jennifer, Jen, Michelle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What else have you watched? You said there were two shows. What's the other one?
Well, I just watched the first episode of another TV show, but I'll save that for next week because I'm going to watch a few more episodes and then I'll have more. Thing of it. No. I've talked about
it's Pluribus. Yeah. Is the show that Cal's talking about. I watched a couple of movies real quick. I won't break them down. Break it down. I finally watched Michael Mann's Thief from 1981, starring James Caan. This is like kind of the beginning of neon noir. As a thing, I mean, there aren't that many films in that genre, but Drive is definitely one. It's one of those, like, I don't know. I feel like it can be one of those bro films that, like, guys are like, oh, bro, you got to watch Thief. But it truly is a fantastic film. Essentially, it charts, like, 2 months of this jewel thief's life where... everything looks like it's going to work out for him, and then in the last act everything's taken away from him by this mob boss, and then what happens after that. It is shot so... I'm not usually a massive fan of Michael Mann. People like Michael Mann because of how intricate he is. So Michael Mann directed
Heat,
thank you. More recently, Ferrari, the biopic, which had one of the most hilarious CGI crash scenes I've ever seen in my life. Me and a friend of the show, Nicola, were watching it together in a cinema, and this crash scene happened that was meant to be tragic, and both of us burst out laughing because it just looked so unreal. But yeah, if you want to know why Michael Mann has a career and why people hold him up with such reverence as an auteur, this film is where it starts. And it's his first film as well. Like, it just... There's some scenes that are just so beautifully shot that set... what's it called when people go and find where things are being shot? Like the people, the location scouts and stuff who have found... It's just, and it's shot between Chicago and LA, and so it's got that real travelogue feel of like the early 80s as well. James Caan, super underrated actor. I think he kind of gets pigeonholed as like the sort of hard man guy in most of his films, and he does play that role a lot. But there's scenes in this film where like there's a scene between him and his new girlfriend, and they're basically talking about how they were both abused as children without saying it, and it's awful and touching, and James Caan's amazing in it. Fantastic film. Four and a half. Maybe 4.5 because the art direction is stupendous. So go and watch Thief. Another film that I finally caught up on is a documentary called An Accidental Studio. It's a documentary about Handmade Films, which was the company George Harrison set up in 1980 to be able to fund The Life of Brian.
I'm going to watch this.
Life of Brian got greenlit by EMI, and then the head of EMI, his name's like Lord Baron Fucksmith or some shit, read the script and was like, we can't make this, this is blasphemous. And so Eric Idle was hanging out with George at a party a few weeks later and told George the story. And George was like, I'll get you the money. And Eric told the Pythons and they were like, you know, and Eric tells the story in the documentary of like, we're friends, but like, friends don't just go off and find £5 million for you. You know what I mean? Like, that's, and he did. George went to his business manager and was like, I want to fund this film. How can we make it happen? And his business manager came back and was like, we can do it if we start a movie production company, which is how Handmade Films got made. And then there is I'll save that for the end. It's an amazing story. It's basically what George Harrison did with his time from 1980 to about 1990. He didn't really make any music in that decade because he was producing movies. And he's kind of credited a couple of other people in the company as well, but kind of credited with bringing the British movie scene back from the dead. The year before Brian was made, only 22 British films were made.
Jesus.
And by the time George had sort of ducked out of the industry, the average was about 70 to 80 British films a year being made. Jesus. So Handmade Films had a massive impact on, you know, the indigenous film industry there. I won't tell you each in, because the stories are interesting in themselves, and there'll be a lot of films where you'll be like, oh, fuck, I didn't realize George's company made that. The only thing that was slightly kind of like, was there a lot of the Monty, outside of Eric Idle, a lot of the Monty Python, because he worked with Monty Python a lot of the interviews with those guys were from other Monty Python documentaries.
Right.
So I was a bit like, oh, surely you could have... there were a lot of talking heads with like Richard E. Grant.
A lot of them are dead.
No, only two of them are dead. Yeah, two out of six. There's
some of them are, you know.
Terry Gilliam is in it. Eric Idle is in it. Michael Palin is in it as well. So it's John Cleese and Terry Jones. Anyway, whatever. It's great. It's a fantastic documentary. It gives you really good insight in the British film industry. And so it will give you a whole list of films you want to go off and watch. I'm going to give it 3.5 grumps.
3.5 grumps.
Yeah, really good. And you would really like it, Bob.
No, I'm going to watch it. Yeah, I definitely want to watch it.
And we finished Friends. This has been, how long have we been doing this for? 3 months?
Yeah, I don't know, 2 months maybe. We're trying to watch Friends. Just like an episode or two a night.
I feel like they land the show. Like they stuck the landing of Friends, right? Don't you reckon?
Yeah.
You're kind of more watching this to watch me watch the show, I feel.
Yeah, because I feel like I rewatched it, you know, during COVID. But there was, I mean, I'm glad that you see that Ross was the worst, because a lot of men walked away from Friends like, well, nah, you know, blah, 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 defending Ross. And I think you look back now with the normal eyes and it's like, oh, no, he's a gaslighting piece of garbage.
It actually gives me a pretty good... marker of like me in my early 30s the last time I watched it compared to me in my mid 40s and the growth in my attitude towards women in that time has been exponential, you know, like but it's so fucking obvious. I don't even think, you know, maybe if you're a 20 year old, like, or 18-year-old like I was watching the first time and didn't really notice Ross. If I wasn't really watching it that much. But even the big romantic moment, and I feel like this happens in a lot of rom-coms where this behavior gets rewarded, but in reality it's actually really psycho. And so for anyone who's never watched The End of Friends, The End of Friends is Chandler and Monica are having kids, they're adopting kids, and they're moving out to the burbs. So the apartment where everything happens is not the apartment anymore. Those two aren't going to be there. So it's the end of the show. Even though you and me were saying, like, why doesn't Joey just take the apartment? Like,
anyway. Yeah, it's a nicer apartment.
Yeah, or Ross and Rachel could take it. Oh, Ross has got a pretty nice apartment. Anyway, the third last episode of the show ever, Rachel bumps into Mark, who's like from, what, season two or something?
Yeah.
He works at Gucci.
Yeah, was it Louis Vuitton or Gucci or something? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was Gucci.
An officer a job in Paris.
Officer a job in Paris, which of course she takes because she gets to be, was it like head buyer or something like that or something?
Never mind
like
that she's got a child with a man in this country, and to take that child away from him would be pretty shit.
Yes. Well, yes, but they do kind of try and explain that in the show of like Rachel does bring that up of like, and they're going to pay for Ross to come out and they'll pay for me to come home. And so, you know, the kid will see both parents as much as possible. It wasn't like she was just like, I'm taking this job and I don't give a fuck. Like, do you know what I mean? Like she says, like, oh, I know it's going to be hard for Ross and we'll make it work. And we'll, you know, Emma will see, or Emily or whatever her name is, will see both parents as much as possible. And then, like, you know, the weird thing about Friends is the kids are there. You never see them. They never really talk about it.
Mm.
You don't see Ben.
Nah, not really.
You don't see Ross's first child from, like, season five onwards. He's not – do you know what I mean? But, yeah, the whole, like, Ross waits till the last episode to rush to the airport and he goes to the wrong airport and then he goes to this other airport and then finally talks – Rachel off the plane, she got off the plane, and like everything's happily ever after in the end. But I don't like it because, again, Rachel has given up what she wants for Ross. You know what I mean? And so like his selfishness. Like, there's a – remember we were watching it last night, and he comes in, he talks to Joey and Phoebe. He's like, I'm not going to tell her how I feel. And I was like, oh, great. And he's like, because what if she rejects me? And I was like, oh, you're so close. You're so close to saying the correct thing. I'm not going to tell her how I feel because I've left it to the last minute, and this is her dream job. This is her passion. And if I really loved her, if I, you know, I really love her, so I want her to go and succeed. Now, and I feel like rom-coms are always that, right? Like someone's going off, usually the woman is going off to pursue what she wants, and then a man drags her back into a fucking shitty scenario by one act of like hugeness, right? Mm. But you know that he's going to go back to being that shitty guy the next day. Like, we were talking about, like, what would happen with the rest, with the guys from Friends. What were you saying? You were like,
I said that in 10 years' time, things are very different because they got, one couple's got twins, the other couple has, you know, a kid and a half. Mike and Phoebe are probably going to have a kid. Who knows what happened, you know, and then
Joey moves to LA.
So it's like, because I think there's sometimes you kind of look at it and go, you know, you miss having those friendship circles from your 20s and then I guess early 30s, whatever, but they're never going to last because people move on, and it's not like people are terrible people and they, you know, we don't give a shit about our friends. Like, I won't see some of my friends for months, but it's just because we can't, you know. But then when we see each other, it's good.
Hmm.
And we don't yell at each other or give each other a hard time because we don't see you. Like, how come I never see you anymore? That's a drag. If I had a friend that's like, how come I never, I probably wouldn't see you because I'm just like, oh, listen, we're all busy. You know what I mean? Like, just stop ruining us.
Yeah, can't we enjoy?
Just enjoy the fact that, like, listen, we're busy. No one means it. It's all good. So just enjoy when you see each other.
Yeah, there's a neediness there in that kind of line of inquiry, right? Like, how come I never see you anymore? It's like, oh, fuck, dude.
It's just fine. Like, so I feel like, you know, you don't grieve or don't. It's also a TV show. You know, you kind of go, oh, you know, look at this friendship group. Like, I'll tell you now, if it were real in 10 years' time, you know, they live far away now. They're not going to be seeing each other as much. You know,
Rachel and Ross are getting divorced. 5 to 6 years after that, they're divorced. Like, they get married again that year, and I guarantee you they're divorced again or split up.
Well, he might. Nothing sure. Hopefully he backs off a bit, like, in terms of, because he is quite controlling. Like, I just imagine Emma being 16 and dating boys and him being crazy.
Yeah.
But I reckon.
He's a legitimate psycho.
Yeah. I reckon, though, that I think that because he realized that he loved Rachel and they didn't want to lose her again, I think that he's going to back down a bit and she's going to be a bit more pants wearing in their relationship, because I feel like.
If that happens, maybe they make it.
But that's the only way they could make it.
If Rachel takes charge of the relationship. But I don't know if that's going to happen, because she's just been subservient to Ross again. You know, Ross has made the demands of what should happen in the relationship and she's like, yeah, all right.
I don't know. I think that he...
Maybe she gets a good job. Like, you know, she gets a similar job but in America. Like, and yeah, she like... Yeah, I don't know.
We don't know.
Because Ross has got tenure, so he's not going to be working much. So maybe he's more of a stay-at-home dad. I think Monica and Chandler are fine. I think they make it. I think they really love each other. Mm-hmm. I think they're going to be good parents. They'll just be, you know,
yeah.
A bit like, I think they'll probably end up a lot like Monica's parents, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I think, yeah, it's fine. Like, I had
Phoebe
a few
and
cheers.
Mike are good. But yeah. that friendship group, yeah, because Phoebe and Mike will stay in the city, nothing surer. Chandler and Monica are out in the suburbs. So that Phoebe will drift out of that group.
Yeah, I think so. I think that Phoebe and Mike will end up living in New York.
Yeah.
And the others move away, which is what happens. It's very rare for you
Ross
to...
Ross and Rachel would move out to where Chandler and Monica are,
I think
are,
so.
Right?
I reckon eventually.
And they're
especially
all family, so they're going to be seeing each other all the time. And
yeah,
stuff.
But remember, Ben lives in the city... with his lesbian parents.
Well, Ross would have to commute into the city because he's a lecturer
well,
at
so would she.
NYU, right?
Yeah, well, so would she, you know what I mean?
So maybe they see Phoebe and stuff. Maybe they catch up for dinner on a Friday night or something. Or
well, we can only...
But it's just hard. Like, with once kids are in the picture, it just, you know, like, you just can't.
I've got a lot of mates who... Like, I've got mates who are like, get me out of the house.
Yeah.
I need a break. I've got a lot of those mates. But then I also got other mates that... Like, I don't want to go out. I want to spend time with my kids. Like, generally, and then normally that's some of the people that I know that work a lot. They're the ones that are like, oh, on the weekend, I want to stay home and spend time with my kids.
Mm.
You know, so it's weird. There's a double. I don't know what the facts that intertwine that say why some parents are like, get me out of this fucking house.
Mm.
You know, like I've got some female friends definitely who are like, no kids, please, no kids. Like, we're going out for dinner, no children. But then I've got other parents who are like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't, and normally the ones that are, you know, like, you know, like if they've separated, like if they've got their kids that weekend, they're like, no. No catching up, spending time with children. But then I've got
but that's
people that go away
got
a lot.
The other weekend to
I mean, it's 100% fair. Yeah. But even then there's like, I don't know. But then I've got friends that kind of have to go away a little bit for work. Hmm. So when they're home, they're like, nah, it's a family weekend, you know, which is nice to hear, you know. But some of them, some of them are like, get me out of this
fucking
house.
You're never
going to
judge someone for like,
no.
She'd never get off the phone and be like, oh, my friend wants to spend time with their kids. What a cunt.
It's actually nice to hear it.
Especially when you've...
It's nice to hear people that have that non-negotiable, you know. I actually think it's...
Especially
like,
when you consider the kind of parenting that was going on when we were kids.
Yeah, like there was even a mate I saw the other week. He has his kids, so joint custody 50-50. So every Sunday. Non-negotiable every Sunday. So he must have the kids from Sunday till like... I don't know, Wednesday or Thursday, you know. And I'm like, good for you. You know what I mean? Like, that's great. Like, it's just, yeah, I think it's good. Anyway, we should wrap up because I need to go to the toilet.
Yeah, I was just going to say the other thing with the other thing that's realistic about the friends in Friends is there's no one else in the friendship circle except Paul Rudd, who shows up in like season 9. You know, the like there's just 6 people who are friends and then they're not friends with anyone else ever.
Yeah.
Phoebe seems to have friends, but yeah, the rest
sometimes
of
she'll have like a, you know, someone who does, you know, fucking weird drum solos or whatever, friends, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, what a ride, Friends.
What a ride.
What are we giving it, grump wise?
I don't know. 3.5?
I'm going to give it 4. I had a really enjoyable time.
Yeah, I just
Friends.
Hate Ross so much. But
Ross sucks. The gay panic sucks.
The gay panic annoys me, that show. And Ross's gaslighting shits me.
Ross is awful. But everybody else I love. I'm so happy that the Chandler and Monica got together. Yay. Hopefully Monica drops the fucking domineering wife bit because I don't think that's who she really is. Joey's the best. Phoebe's great. Love them all. Anyway, as we say here at Should We Watch It Headquarters, when it's time for Kelly to potty, it's time to end the potty.
Yay.
Thanks for listening to us,
guys.
A lot of people binge listening or going back and listening to old episodes. Appreciate that. We love you very much, and we'll talk to you on the next episode. Oh, should we just watch it real quick?
Yay.
Love you, bye.
Love you, bye.